I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass, and I'm all out of bubblegum.
There are, of course, those who do not want us to speak.
Greed, deception, abuse of power, that's no plan.
They gatekeep knowledge, you know, they're total masters of deception. They manipulate everything. You know, these pricks at the helm have lied to us.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people.
They're setting it up for the Great Deception.
Yeah, I mean, it all revolves around the Great Deception.
Yeah, right? Bingo. And L.A. and I talked about that. I said, L.A., is this the Great Deception? And he didn't hesitate. He said, absolutely.
For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day.
The world needs a wake-up call. We're going to phone it in.
And welcome to the Great Deception Podcast. I'm your host, Matt. Thanks for joining me. Guys, I'm excited to announce I've finally taken the step forward, and I'm going to start taking contributions to the show. I've opened up a Venmo account, as well as started a Patreon. And I'm going to figure out how I really want to run the Patreon for now. Right now we have a $3 contribution, a $5 contribution, and a $10. Now the only distinguishable benefit right now is for the $10 tier, we're going to hold a once a month, kind of like ask me anything, you know, research a topic maybe. It won't be recorded. It'll just be a Zoom meeting with the patrons, and it should be fun. You know, I'm looking forward to more interaction, more things like that. And the reason why I'm looking for the contributions, guys, is A, you know, the cost to put together the show isn't that great, but the materials too. You know, all the books I'm buying. You know, I would like to get a website up so I could get some more interaction with you all and get some other things out there on the web. But for now, we are where we are. So we're going to slowly start growing. Now, addition to those, I also started a little merch shop. So we have a couple of different t-shirt designs out there on teespring.com. Guys, all the links to all this are in the show notes. So you can check down below and you can find all the links right there. T-shirts are really cool. I think, obviously, I created them, so I'm a little biased. No, but I made a couple, logo shirts for the podcast, and then had some fun with some old buildings and things like that. And so go check it out. Got some mugs out there, tumblers, glasses, things like that. And then it's mainly just t-shirts, the hoodies. And guys, the reason why I waited, I been working on this stuff for the last month or so, but I actually got my samples the other day, and I got to tell you, man, I love the t-shirts. They're good quality. They're comfortable. The hoodie, I got one of the hoodies so far. It is, you know, it's in the rotation now. One of my go-to hoodies, although hopefully I won't need it, being that we're going into summer now up here in New England. You never know. But guys, go check that out. And I knocked down the price so to try to get them as cheap as possible on there. You know, with the way they do it, it's like, you know, I could charge you like $50 for a sweatshirt. Get out of here. No, I'm not going to do that. I'd rather make like a dollar or two on a sweatshirt and let a bunch of people get them than, you know, overcharge. So go check out the merch. It's really cool stuff. And then if you want, you can go check out patreon.com/The Great Deception Podcast and see what we got going out there. and we will grow that as well. So the other thing I wanted to go over is I'm really working on some deep dives right now on some different subjects, and the only problem is it's not enough hours in the day. I know everyone says that, but right now I'm in the heart of my son's Little League season, so we're going 4 nights a week with that, and then I don't record on the nights that I have him, so it really limits my ability to get some research done and things like that. So what I'm just saying is some of these shows may get, you may not get your weekly Great Deception podcast. You'll always get your Monday Night Master Debaters weekly. That is a that's always on the schedule, so you will get that. But with these, I may start breaking up some of the longer ones into two segments also, just to spread them out. I know some of these deep dives, and this one tonight might be one of those where I want to split it up into two parts, just because it's you know, the research that I did on it and digging into it, I want to give you guys the details of it because it's just something that's mind-blowing. So, you know, you'll see. I may be able to crank out some episodes, but there may be some weeks where I don't get into the deep dives. But I'd also like to start getting into a little bit more interviews, but I really got to find someone that I'm interested in. You know, I'm not just going to present anyone to you guys. I want to find somebody that I can have a good conversation with and bring something to you. You know, I know you don't want to listen to me babble, that's for sure, because I don't want to listen to it either. So with that said, enough babbling. Let's get on to the show. So tonight, what we have is, I don't know if many people are familiar with it, but what was called Black Wall Street. And this is in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in the 1920s, early 1900s. And what happened there is atrocious. And what happened there is criminal. And many would say what happened there was intentional. It was set up. It was a false flag to lead to further events. Now, where do we see some of this stuff? Just in the news today, I just so happened to see there was a white mass shooter who left a manifesto and all this other stuff, you know, which just so conveniently fits into the government's message of trying to, you know, do gun control and things like that. And then also they can now, because he used the internet, they can hit the tech companies to censor us even harder. So guys, what you have to do is you have to see when these big events happen that... And I hate to say it, but not all the time they're real. I know the outcome is real. There are dead people because of it. But the reason why that person is there is not always just a coincidence. Sometimes they have backing. So with that said, let's get into this. So what you have to understand is what happened in Tulsa in 1921 is they allegedly, the National Guard dropped bombs on American citizens. You know, literal bombs. They say that they were racist white Oklahomans who used, you know, airplanes, guns, rope, and fire to eliminate a wealthy black neighborhood and all its families called Black Wall Street. And that's what the survivors said. You know, they, and luckily this happened in 1921. So in the late 90s, when the investigation began into it again, there were grandchildren alive. There were children at the time that were alive that were witnesses to what happened, and they were able to testify. And you know, you look at it and what these, and it wasn't just blacks, it was Native American families too, because this area obviously was big for the natives, and it was just newly developed. We're talking 1920, and we'll get into this. The city of Tulsa was only founded in 1905. So we're talking about 15 years here that it's been around. So there's people that know exactly what happened, you know, and at least one of the photographers scratched a message into their images saying, running the Negroes out. The papers called the tragedy a riot, as if to blame the quote unquote blacks. Again, making themselves into the victim when they're the ones committing the crime. And I'm not talking about the blacks here, okay? When actually the blacks were killed and images of the murders were sold on postcards and even hung in living rooms as fun, fantastic art. The leftover bodies were unceremoniously dropped in the Arkansas River or into mass graves. The images of Greenwood Street, aka Black Wall Street, in 1920s America, okay? Why did they go after these people? because these people had oil, they had buildings, they had cars, they had money, success, pride, and their white neighbors got mad after trying to lynch Dick Rowland, a black man who was wrongfully accused of attacking a young white woman in an elevator. Black World War I veterans came to Rowland's aid. Hours later, a white mob launched the mass murder of what some say at least 300 in a situation that still isn't mentioned in many school history books today. Although the riot itself lasted only a few hours, its repercussions are still felt today. Okay, and what we're talking about is Black Wall Street, Tulsa, Oklahoma, a wealthy neighborhood, a wealthy city, black city, exclusively for the most part. And their white neighbors didn't like it. They wanted that. So let's see what happened. So did the governor at the time have ties to the Klan in Tulsa? Well, Governor Charles Haskell played a crucial role in drafting the Oklahoma Constitution and Oklahoma's admission into the U.S. in 1907. Okay, so we're talking 14 years later now. But so Mr. Haskell was a lawyer, an oil man, and a politician. You know, he hated criticism, though. And one of the things that he did on more than one occasion was to have journalists who questioned his policies arrested and jailed for criminal libel. I mean, come on. This guy is, he's full of himself. And let's get into him some more. His racist past was also underscored by his campaign speeches, his efforts to write and pass Jim Crow legislation. We all know what Jim Crow legislation is, right? If not, look it up. Disenfranchising thousands of African Americans. And his political friendships, including Tulsa's Tate Brady, a member of the Ku Klux Klan and a founder of the city of Tulsa. So Mr. Tate Brady, a member of the KKK and a hotel owner, he would be appointed by Haskell to the governor's Capital Relocation Commission. Okay, and this was a big thing about where they were going to place the capital. Again, it was all about money and power here. If they decided where they could put it, they could, you know, have some handshakes, make some deals, and there we go. So, in 1921, less than a decade after the Capitol was relocated, Brady would serve as a watchman for the Klan during the massacre. Tulsa race massacre, that is. Then in 1910, with less than a year remaining on his term, Haskell developed and pushed for the passage of Jim Crow laws and the state's notorious Grandfather Clause, which established literacy requirements for African American voters, forcing them to prove to their ancestors had registered to vote prior to 1866. So again, guys, these are just bogus ways to throw up roadblocks. And blatantly obvious. So let's get into another one. Mr. James B.A. Robertson. Okay, he was an American lawyer and a judge, and actually at the time was the governor of Oklahoma. He was appointed by Mr. Haskell, okay? And he, to serve as a district judge back in the day. So now, what kind of ties does Robertson have? Well, he is the sovereign, well, they call it the Grand Sire, which is the Grand Master of the Sovereign Grand Lodge of the Independent Order of the Odd Fellows from 1915 to 1916. And we may get into the Odd Fellows down the road because they are a very interesting group with some ties. They were all about orphans, very Masonic feel to them. So look into the Odd Fellows if you have any questions. So now, who are some other players in this? On the other side of the things, you have a guy named O.W. Gurley. Okay, he was a wealthy African-American landowner from Arkansas who traversed the United States, and he came into Oklahoma for the Oklahoma land run of 1889. So in 1906, he moved to Tulsa, and he purchased 40 acres of land, which he said was only to be sold to colored people. Black ownership was unheard of at the time. So Black Wall Street was the wealthiest black community in the United States. You had the wealthy middle class, the poor blacks, all living on the same block. And so many of those individuals who started out in the working class because they live there, would eventually go on to own their own business in the Greenwood District. He said that's the results of Gurley's contribution. This guy was all about building up this community and trying to help his people as much as he could. And it said out of the 600 businesses in Tulsa, Gurley owned at least 100 as a result of demand and need. What Gurley did was for the long term, for the generations who never would have met him. He believed that black people had a better chance of economic progress if they pooled their resources, worked together, and supported each other's business. It's a brilliant idea and something we have to think about going back to today. He bought large tracts of real estate in the northeastern part of Tulsa, which he subdivided and sold exclusively to other African Americans. Okay? So a number of the blacks soon followed suit, right? You had a guy named Stratford. He later built the Stratford Hotel on Greenwood, where, you know, this hotel was a luxurious hotel. We're talking like high-end amenities and you know, things that you could only find in white hotels at the time, which black people weren't allowed into. And that's what it said. The Stratford Hotel was the largest black-owned hotel in the United States. So although Gurley did all this great stuff and bought all this and built up this great community, it was short-lived, right? In the matter of moments, he lost everything. He said, it was during, you know, in a matter of a day when this race war broke out, he lost his hotel, he lost his parlor, he lost his cafe, he owned, buildings all over the place, his barbershop, you know, everything. Ruined. It says he lost nearly $200,000 at the time, which is equivalent of a couple million today. Now, what was so amazing about this community is that the dollar circulated, they say, anywhere between 30 and 100 times in this community, which means the money just stayed in the community. They didn't spend their money elsewhere. They kept it within. They kept the wealth within. And it was amazing because Oklahoma only had two airports, but there were six black families that owned their own planes at this time in the 1920s. And like we said before, they did everything they could in Oklahoma to make even these successful people who had proven, you know, I love how they tried to say, oh, they're inferior, you know, they don't deserve the right to vote. Bullshit. These people were living better than most people in America at the time. Yet, they still had voting restrictions. You know, they had to pay a poll tax. They had to take literacy tests. How degrading is that? You have to prove to the man that you can vote. And then, one of the things we have to understand is that lynchings were just exploding across the country at this time. So we're talking 1921 is a Tulsa race riot. We're going to hop back 2 years to 1921 and look at the red, or 1919, the red summer of 1919, which is a, you know, a period from the winter of 1918 into the fall, all the way through fall of 1919, where white supremacists, their terrorism, and they took race riots there across more than three dozen cities in America, okay? It marked the culmination of, like, heavy tensions between the migration of the African Americans out of the South, right, to the North, especially during World War I, and this is still lingering from the Civil War, okay? So, but now when we look at, now we're looking at World War I, because now a lot of these black veterans are coming back from the war. And it said, when the African Americans returned in late 1918, thousands, they had their jobs in factories, warehouses, and mills had been filled by newly arrived Southern black people or immigrants. Amid financial insecurity, racial and ethnic prejudices ran rampant, right? They were everywhere. So meanwhile, you know, the African-American veterans who risked their lives fighting for freedom and quote-unquote democracy found that they couldn't even get their own basic rights, like adequate housing or equality under the law, which made them become pissed and militant. So, you have the KKK all over the South right now. In 1918, there were 64 lynchings. 1919, there were 83. Now, I mean, in total, that doesn't sound like a lot, you know, when you think of the numbers, but think about that. Those are probably not mass lynchings, right? So these are a lot of individual instances, which is crazy. I mean, that's just insanity. So in the summer of 1919, race riots would break out in D.C., Knoxville, Longview, Texas, Phillip County, Arkansas, Omaha, Nebraska, and Chicago was one of the biggest ones. And here's why. On July 27th of 1919, a 17-year-old African-American boy named Eugene Williams was swimming in a lake with some friends in Lake Michigan when he crossed an unofficial barrier, okay, which between the white and black beaches. So a group of white men threw stones at Williams, hitting him, and he drowned. When police officers arrived on the scene, they refused to arrest the white men, whom the black eyewitnesses pointed that they knew it was them. So then all of a sudden, violence broke out between gangs, mobs of black and white people all over, especially in the south side of Chicago. Here's the thing. That fighting went on for like 5 or 6 days. There were shootings, you know, beatings, arson, like throwing Molotov cocktails in houses and businesses and things like that. And eventually it left 15 whites and 23 blacks dead and over 500 people injured. Well, what did we talk about? The firebombings left 1,000 black families homeless. You know, it's just, it's insanity. But the biggest violence occurred in rural Arkansas in a town called Elaine, where an estimated 100 to 240 black people and 5 white people were killed. An event now known as the Elaine Massacre. It's crazy. This is what we're coming off of into Tulsa in 1921. As I said before, Tulsa was known as basically the oil capital of the world, or it called it, you know, almost like the self-proclaimed oil capital of the world. And it made itself into, you know, like a manufacturing powerhouse and a transportation hub for the oil fields all around it. So you look at how quickly this town grew. In 1898, it only had like 1,000 people. By 1921, it's all the way up to 72,000. So that's a really quick growth in a little over 20 years. You're talking 70,000 people, which then grew to about 110,000 by, like, I think that was the end of 1921. And it was like one of the most densely populated areas in the state. So most of the people there were native, that they were white, okay? But there were some also, you know, not many of them affiliated themselves with Native Americans, you know, or American Indians, as they say, you know, but 9,000 were black. And they were living in like the Greenwood Ave area of downtown Tulsa. So they were like the laborers. They worked the domestic jobs. But then you had a bunch who were teachers, who were lawyers, who were doctors, and other professionals, because they had the money in the community. So the city was segregated. So you had Greenwood, you know, it had its own schools, had its own post office, had its own police station, its own library, all that stuff, because back then, the whites and the blacks, heaven forbid, they go in the same building. And it also had its own commercial district, which Booker T. Washington called Black Wall Street of America. And how did this happen? Well, you had all these oil fields that took off in the 1905. And what happened? Well, you had the World War, which needed petroleum products. And they just so happened to have it. So it said that 20% of the oil powering all the Allied armies' oil went through Tulsa and their pipeline system and their rail yards or their refineries. Just in like 4 years from the beginning of the war, like around 1917 until 1921, there was like $35-36 million in building permits in Tulsa. I mean, it's just, the city was just growing, and they built things like Central High School. They built a couple banks, City Hall, post office, and I mean, all of these massive buildings. And we'll see some of them in pictures that I'll show when I put the video version of this out. Now, one of the problems, though, is that the politics in Tulsa were crazy, to say the least. It was basically divided between Republicans and Democrats, and every 2 years it would flip-flop back and forth. So in 1920, T.D. Evans, who was a Republican, was elected mayor, and his whole election campaign was to push through a bond on a reservoir and a pipeline to bring fresh water to Tulsa. So that was his whole big thing. But there was tons of corruption in politics, law enforcement, in Tulsa. So less than 2 weeks before the riot, the Oklahoma Assistant Attorney General led an investigation on the Tulsa Police Department that found that they were poorly trained and sometimes corrupt, and they were so ill-equipped, they did not have a single reliable automobile. So like when officers needed a ride to a crime scene, they were taken in private cars driven by volunteer citizens. I mean, this is like clown show stuff. But the thing is during this time, race really was an issue. Or at least they made it seem to be in everything that I read. It said that many states, including Oklahoma, tried to keep blacks from voting and restricted their activities, sometimes called the Jim Crow laws, and sometimes through intimidation. Increasingly, blacks resisted discrimination. From D.C. to Chicago to the rural Arkansas Delta, the racial conflict degenerated into deadly armed violence, like we're seeing in 1919. All of these things pop up. Yeah, and there's stupid stuff going on. Like, you know, for example, like 3 weeks before the riot, it says a middle-aged black couple was arrested in Tulsa for refusing to sit in the back of a streetcar. And they were fined $10, which at the time is pretty significant fine. But still, I mean, if that was a white car, they wouldn't even bother them. It was so ridiculous. So we look at W.E.B. Du Bois, and he says, "I have never seen a colored community so highly organized as that of Tulsa. The colored people of Tulsa have accumulated property, have established stores and business organizations, and have made money in oil." So what they had, guys, was they had 35 blocks of businesses, housing. This is not a real small area. I mean, it's a pretty significant area that we're talking about. They had, by 1910, they had their own black bricklayers. So, I mean, they're starting to do all this stuff. They built their own theater, the Dreamland Theater, which I highly recommend taking a look at. It's a beautiful theater. They had their own private transportation network that was built out of, you know, Model T Fords and different buses and things like that. They would drive the residents down to Tulsa if they needed to. They had pool halls, they had auto body shops, they had beauty parlors, grocery stores, barbershops, funeral homes, you name it. You know, they even had like a YMCA, they had a roller skating rink, hospitals, post office. It was really a community-oriented thing. And they had a couple of churches, but the most impressive was the Mount Zion Baptist Church, which was built in 1909. And again, this is a very... Again, it looks old-worldy building. It's a very nice church. But also, on the other side of it, it will play a role in this race riot. And then, obviously, we talked about before, which was the Stratford Hotel, which is the largest owned black hotel. It had 54 suites, a gambling hall, a dining room, a saloon, and a pool hall. You know, you look at it, and this guy John Rogers Jr. says, "Greenwood shows that when we are left to our own devices and don't have a knee to our neck, we can achieve extraordinary things." That's an interesting alliteration he uses there with the whole knee to the neck after what we went through in 2020. The violent uprising, which has been referred to as the Black Holocaust. Where have we seen that before, right? We see that term thrown around a lot. Utterly destroying the region in a matter of hours. An estimated 300 African American died. 800 were admitted to local hospitals, and 10,000 were left homeless. The riot destroyed the community, as 600 businesses were destroyed, including local churches, restaurants, supermarkets, movie theaters, schools, libraries, private airplanes, post offices, banks, hospitals, and their public transportation. Now, the one thing I will say is that 300 number is not confirmed. Okay, what they have in a lot of the death tolls is around 33. an interesting number in itself, but we'll get into that as we go through what actually transpired. One of the things to think about, though, they had segregation. They got what they wanted. But when it worked, the white people still had a problem with it, right? The government still had a problem with it. So what did they do? They incited violence. The only thing that they usually tend to do. Now, what we're going to get into now is the incident itself that triggered this all off. And I've heard multiple stories, and I'll let you do your own research and see what you find. But here's what happened. On Monday, May 30th, 1921, a young black man named Dick Rowland got into an elevator on the third floor of the Drexel building. For some reason, he came into contact with Sarah Page, a white elevator operator, and Page cried out. Her cry was heard by a store clerk who called police. The building was, you know, it was probably quiet because it's Memorial Day weekend, right? And most of the stores were closed. It says almost nothing is known about Sarah Page, originally described as a 17-year-old orphan. Interesting. Working her way through business college, it later developed that she may have been as young as 15 and had come to Tulsa from Kansas City while waiting for a divorce to be finalized. Yeah, she's got a crazy background that I couldn't get a solid story. I heard multiple stories about her, but one was that she was an orphan. And we hear a lot about the orphans from the late 1800s, early 1900s. So we look, people who knew Rowland said the elevator did not stop level with the third floor threshold, causing him to trip as he entered the car and fall against Paige. So he tripped and fell and bumped into her. Police later said that whatever happened, it most certainly not intentional. In any case, Paige's cry caught the attention of a Renberg's employee, you know, the department store, who called police. Rowland fled, but Paige and the clerk, she didn't name him, but she said the man that attacked her, and she gave him a description well enough, and they had no problem finding out who he was. Now, there's some people that say that Paige was related to the mayor, T.D. Evans. It was his niece of some sort, or some relation to him, and that this was kind of an orchestrated event, and that even maybe some of the newspapers had articles ready before the event actually happened to incite this. So we're going to get into the newspapers right now. So Rowland's arrest the next morning was reported in the front page in that afternoon's Tulsa Tribune, headlined "Nab Negro for Attacking Girl in Elevator." The somewhat sensational account reported that Rowland was to be charged with attempted assault. It said Rowland scratched Paige and tore her clothes. This was the equivalent of an accusation of attempted rape. The mere suggestion of attempted assault, when it involved a white woman, had in the past triggered gruesome lynchings from Duluth, Minnesota, to the Florida swamps. So this is not good. This is the newspaper intentionally inciting this situation. Okay, and let's go on. Some sources say that the Tribune also published an editorial under the headline "To Lynch Negro Tonight." This is possible, but it doesn't seem likely. For one, the Tribune actually editorialized against lynching both before and after the riot. A call for vigilante justice would have been almost as inconceivably inconsistent. So they're saying it's not likely that this was the case. Also, no such editorial has ever been found. This in itself does not prove that it doesn't exist. The only known copies of the May 31st, 1921 Tribune were an early, quote-unquote, state edition, essentially a reprint of previous day's last edition, and therefore of no use. And microfilm image of a film copy made in the 1940s. The front page arrest stories has been torn from this paper, and part of the back page, the editorial page, was missing. This has led to speculation that the inflammatory editorial was torn out along with the arrest story. So there is reason to question, right? It seems suspect that they would rip this article out. Is it likely? Probably not. Is it possible? Yes. Okay, I'm not going to say it's not possible, but it's unlikely. A surviving quote-unquote state edition from June 1st, 1921 shows the arrest story on the front page. The space where the missing editorial would have been is a piece on a European disarmament. So make of it what you would. Was it really disarmament or was it an editorial? It says here, the editorials could have been switched, but more likely explanation is that confusion arose over an editorial that appeared on the front page of the June 1 Tribune. This editorial condemned lynching, but included the phrase, a story starts that a Negro in the county jail was to be lynched. I don't know. They used inflammatory terms to get this thing going, like assault. And even the Black Dispatch, the black paper in town, on May 31st, wrote a story under the headline, The False Story Which Set Tulsa on Fire. The Tulsa World, on June 1st, tweaked the Tribune for its colored account of an elevator incident. So you have the papers even going at it now. Paige, the girl who seems to have fled the city on June 1st, subsequently wrote the county attorney asking that the charges against Roland be dropped. The case was dismissed at the end of September. Little more than 3 months later, this is dropped by her request. Just how much the Tribune story actually contributed to what followed has been debated since the day it appeared. Police Chief John Gustafson and Police Commissioner J.M. Atkinson minimized its importance. Of course they would. And the word of Roland's arrest almost certainly would have gotten around anyway. But others, including, according to a report, Governor Robertson, thought the story was the root cause of the riot. And I would say it definitely didn't help. It certainly didn't help. Okay, so now we're getting into it. So at 4 p.m., an anonymous caller told Police Commissioner J.M. Atkinson, we are going to lynch that Negro, that black devil who assaulted that girl. Atkinson and Police Chief John Gustafson arranged to move Roland from the city jail to a more secure county lockup on the top floor of the courthouse at 6th Street in Boulder Ave. Whites, attracted by the rumors, began gathering at the courthouse until there was about 2,000 of them. Okay, so this isn't a small crowd. Now we have 2,000 people outside threatening to lynch someone who has not even had a chance to, right, hasn't gone to court yet, but they're ready to lynch him. The local guys wanted the sheriff to take him out of town. Sheriff refused. He said that he was safer in jail than in a car on the open road somewhere, which you can't really argue with. You never know. These guys could have ran him off the road, could have killed him, whatever. You got 2,000 people out there. The sheriff, he was not about to make the same mistake his friend made the previous year when his friend allowed a mob to take murder suspect Roy Belton from the jail. The lynching that ensued essentially ended his friend's career in elective office and led to the sheriff being elected as sheriff in 1920. What they did is, rather than try and get him out of town, they put him up in the county courthouse on the sixth floor, county jail in the sixth floor of the courthouse, and they had six of the deputies barricade themselves inside with Roland, the prisoner. Then what they did is they sent this guy, Barney Cleaver, okay? If we're ever going to talk, like, this guy sounds like he's straight out of Mayberry. Deputy Barney Cleaver. They stayed behind. They were trying to get rid of the crowd outside. What's going on? Now the black people start hearing, holy shit, there's this crowd gathering outside the courthouse. They're looking to lynch our friend. So what do? They start assembling at the offices of A.J. Smitherman's newspaper, the Tulsa Star, on Greenwood Ave. After arming themselves, they marched and drove to the courthouse. This was taken very seriously, and it says, although Tulsa did not have a history of racial violence, the 1920 lynching victim, Roy Belton, was white. It did have more than its share of vigilantism. During World War I, citizens had been harassed and beaten in the name of patriotism, under the color of the local council of defense or the home guard. Okay, this group is important here. A local militia organized to replace the National Guard units called on to active duty. So during World War I, when the active duty officers, National Guard, went off, these home guard or a local militia would come in. It's crazy. What these people would do. They would come in and they would harass black families for no reason. They're not these protectors, so to speak. So this woman, Mary Jones Parrish, she put her stuff in a little book called The Events of the Tulsa Disaster, which I read. And she went outside on the night of May 31st to find that some of our group were going to be going to give added protection to Roland, right? So this is the black people going down to protect. At least two earlier contingents of concerned blacks had already visited the courthouse, but McCullough and Cleaver assured them that Roland was in good hands and persuaded them just to go back to Greenwood. Okay, so I don't know. It's tough to tell what the white crowd was there for, right? I mean, there obviously some of them were there for blood. They were there for a lynching. But a lot of the people were just curious, because we're talking about a time when television isn't prominent, the news isn't exactly getting out faster. You're basically relying on your newspaper to get you the news. So they were really going out to check it out. They just wanted to see what was going on. But on the other hand, they weren't completely docile either. McCullough, it said, was hooted down, the Tulsa World reported, when he tried to disperse the whites. Shortly before the shooting started, a band of irate whites presented themselves at the National Guard Armory about a mile east of the courthouse, demanding weapons and threatening to break in when they were denied. So what happened is at 8:20 was really the only time anyone tried to get in the courthouse to get at Roland. And it says three unidentified white men entered the courthouse. But McCullough told them there'd been some talk about a lynching and that they might as well get out because no one was going to get to that Negro. All right. Really, really reassuring words there from him. Then he said he ordered his men to run the building's lone elevator to the top floor, disable it, and barricade themselves inside the jail. Over the next hour and a half, McCullough received several telephone calls from concerned black leaders, as well as from Major James A. Bell of the local Oklahoma National Guard. McCullough assured them the situation was under control. And then it says Gustafson, who was even more concerned, but instead of trying to break up the crowd at the courthouse, he was focused his attention on the armed blacks. Of course, they're the biggest threat. Eventually, he asked Major Bell for help to clear the street of Negroes. But Bell told him only the governor could call the local guardsmen into service. Thankfully, because the guard did not need to be used there. But then things start to get out of control. So at about 10 o'clock, a former county investigator named E.S. McQueen confronted a black man, who some say was named Johnny Cole, in front of the courthouse. As McQueen and Cole wrestled for McQueen's gun, it discharged. As more than one person observed, all hell then broke loose. The crowd scattered, and then McCullough, who had been dispersing the crowd and working with the crowd, he ran for cover in a nearby hotel. Then this gentleman, Walter Daggs, who was a local oil company manager, he just lived near the courthouse, was shot and killed, apparently, they say, by a stray bullet. A 16-year-old, Homer Klein, was killed as he left the bank where he worked. A.B. Stick was gunned down outside the Tulsa Hotel. He was supposed to die, but somehow he survived. What we were alluding to before, it says news of the fatalities and injuries were often fragmentary, secondhand, and contradictory. So you're getting all sorts of wild stories like you would when something like this breaks out. So denied weapons at the National Guard Armory, the whites, including some police, broke into Barden's Sporting Goods across the street from the courthouse, and they began taking guns, ammo, and just about anything else in sight. The police may have been involved because they got most of their ammo from Barden's, so they knew where to get the ammo. If the National Guard's not going to give it to you, then we're just going to go steal it. Good police department right there. Looting, all of it by rampaging whites, was reported throughout downtown as shots whizzed around. Gustafson called his entire force, which is only about 65 men, and Atkinson began commissioning special deputies. Now, this isn't good. When you start deputizing people in a situation like this, things are going to go wrong. And he deputized 400. Oklahoma National Guard adjutant General Charles Barrett told Colonel L.J.F. Rooney to make his troops available to local authorities, even though it would be hours before they could be officially called to duty. The first few guardsmen to arrive at police headquarters found the street choked with men in uniform, American Legion members assembled in formation. Although no doubt well-intentioned, their presence initially added to the general chaos. It says, with much promiscuous shooting, the Tulsa World reported, The ex-soldiers marched through the business district. Fortunately, the newspaper said, no one was hurt. So then you have this lull. That was like, it was like 2 hours of heavy fighting and chaos. And then there was this lull. So who came back? All of Roland's protectors came back shortly after midnight. So there was like a handful of National Guardsmen there and some volunteers. They tried to get between the black group that's arriving and the whites that were already there. And so what they did is they set up a line on the railroad tracks to keep them separated. And it says, although the fighting never completely stopped, it did die down during the early morning hours, causing many to believe the riot was playing itself out. We didn't have enough men, Rooney said. It would have taken at least 1,000 men to restore any degree of order, and to put an effective guard line about that Negro district would have required that many more. At about 1:30 a.m., Major Byron Kilpatrick of the Oklahoma National Guard finally secured the necessary signature for the telegram formally asking the governor for National Guard assistance. So we're talking 1:30 a.m., right? And that's 3.5 hours after the first shooting. And you know the tension's there. You got to have the guard there right away. Now, was this intentional? Could be. It said, Kirkpatrick's primary obstacle had been getting to Sheriff McCullough, who was still barricaded in the top floor of the courthouse, threatening to shoot anybody who showed himself in the stairwell leading to the jail. A Tulsa World reporter finally persuaded McCullough to let him in with the telegram. So this dude was barricaded in there, just, you know, he's shooting on sight, and they finally convinced him, hey man, you got to read this. Read this telegram. So three National Guard units were in Tulsa at the time. You had a rifle company, a supply company, and a sanitary, like a medical unit. The artillery unit had been authorized, and it was in the process of forming, but it hadn't been equipped yet. So on the night of May 31st and the morning of June 1st, the Tulsa units had like 35 men that were armed. This didn't include the medical unit, which was employed primarily in taking care of the wounded and injured black people because they weren't allowed into hospitals. Besides the guardsmen, Rooney had at his disposal, at least in theory, several hundred ex-servicemen, most of them members of the American Legion post in Tulsa, Broken Arrow, and Bristow, it's called. Rooney put these men under the command of Major Charles Daley. And it just, they just keep passing the buck down and giving more, these random groups, more power to just run a little militia to try and gain any sort of order. But it sounds like the fighting's already died down. So why are they sending these groups out? Okay, so we go, restoring order along the Frisco tracks was not the only concern of authorities. Rumors persisted throughout the night that hundreds of blacks were descending on Tulsa, reinforcing the notion of a Negro uprising and calling Rooney to stretch his men even thinner. So again, guys, there were these rumors that there might be these evil, you know, marauding blacks coming into town to cause a Negro uprising. I mean, come on. This is just, it's all fear-mongering, and it's just a way for them to ramp up the level of their violence. So it says, squads were sent to guard the city power plant and waterworks, while police, ex-servicemen, and special deputies roamed the city in auto patrols, rounding up blacks living in servant quarters outside Greenwood and looking for the supposed invaders. Invaders, these people live here. Rooney and about 30 men and officers established themselves along Detroit Avenue, where gunfire had been exchanged between adjoining white and black neighborhoods. The guardsmen came under fire from both sides. No kidding. They're just sitting ducks. So at dawn, a force of citizens, police, and members of the National Guard, about 1,500 of them, they moved into Greenwood from the south and the west under orders to take protective custody unarmed blacks and to subdue any who resisted. To people in Greenwood, it looked like an invading army, which it sounds like, right? It's telling them to go in, disarm you, and arrest you for doing nothing wrong other than being a resident of the area. This is criminal. You can't do this shit. And this is what we fought about in 2020 up and through now. They can't just do this on their beck and call. there has to be legal repercussions for this. There has to be a way to be able to stand up, because this shit is insane. These people are being rounded up like criminals for doing nothing wrong. This whole situation was blown out of proportion, and now it's turning into a race riot. They said, it then dawned upon us that the enemy had organized in the night and was invading our district, the same as the Germans invaded France and Belgium. This is Mary Jones again, okay? It's exactly the same thing. They were being invaded. This is the typical American government way to do things. Just come in. We're here for peace and freedom, right? No, they're coming in to overthrow, take your resources, and then leave you what's left. If they don't drive you out. So it says, authorities still operating under the premise of a Negro uprising maintained they wanted to get control of Greenwood, not destroy it. They failed on both counts. Most Greenwood residents surrendered peacefully, or they fled northward to get out. They didn't want any part of this. Many were hidden by employers or other acquaintances, and sometimes even total strangers. The few who stayed behind to fight, they were overwhelmed. Right? Because there were just thousands of troops coming in. There's, you know, these militias, the Home Guard. You had all these different groups. The National Guard reported engaging in several short skirmishes and one longer battle in which about 50 blacks, quote unquote, fought like tigers. The last organized resistance came from gunmen in the Mount Baptist Zion Church. Right? We talked about this before. When they refused to come out, the new church, valued at about $80,000, which is probably a couple million today, was set on fire. Along the Frisco tracks, Major Daly and about 25 of his men were trying to hold back an angry horde of perhaps 1,000. Daly said he repeatedly sent for help from the police, but was told they were busy elsewhere. Finally, the crowd broke away from Daly. An invasion in the Negro district began, the Tulsa Tribune writes. Now, here's where it gets crazy. Okay, so not only do you have these guys marauding on the ground, now we're having reports of aircraft and explosives being thrown from aircraft. We have rifle shots being taken from aircraft. Now, we're not talking about way up. We're talking low-flying aircraft. And actually, in the movie The Watchmen, one of the opening scenes is about that. It's about Tulsa in 1921, and you see this airplane fly right down and buzz these people on Main Street. It's wild. And that's what, you know, is alleged to happen. So, as the story goes, 6 aircraft were employed by police during the attack. Local authorities insisted the planes were used solely for reconnaissance purposes, right? Only recon, that's it. Some on the ground, though, said the planes were used to bomb and strafe Greenwood and its fleeing residents, which there's many accounts to that. As a practical matter, dropping explosive or incendiary devices from this type of plane would probably have not been very easy or effective, but it doesn't mean it couldn't happen. Okay, it was an old 2-seater plane from World War I, but it was never used in combat. It's called the JN-4 or the Jenny. The army had a ton of them, you know, a massive surplus, which it sold in kits throughout the country. They were just a shellac-coated canvas fabric over a wood frame. It was nothing special by any means. But they were favored by barnstormers because the aircraft's low cost to own and maintain. Historians are still assessing the viability of witness reports of low-flying airplanes, some raining bullets or incendiaries that became the enduring theme in the reconstruction of the events. But even though only about 15 planes were known to have been stored at local airfields in 1921, it remains a mystery who owned the ones used in the Tulsa attack and how exactly they were mobilized as part of one of the most heinous domestic attacks on American citizens. Okay, so we're going to go back to Miss Mary Jones Parrish. She was a teacher and a journalist at the time in the Greenwood District who gathered photos and firsthand accounts of the massacre, right? And that's what she put in her Events of the Tulsa Disaster, which she published in 1922. And it just got republished in 2021, if anyone wants to go check that out. She recalls seeing fast approaching airplanes, and that more than a dozen airplanes went up and down and began to drop turpentine balls upon the Negro residences. one of the anonymous eyewitnesses she quotes said they saw low-flying planes that left an entire block a mass of flame. As they passed over the district, left them a mass of flame as they passed over the district. Reporting for The Nation, another newspaper, Walter White wrote that 8 airplanes were employed to spy on the movements of the Negroes, and according to some, were used in bombing the colored section. According to the 2001 commission report, black newspapers were full of stories of turpentine and nitroglycerin bombs being dropped and men shooting from airplanes. Okay, so there are numerous eyewitness accounts of this. But of course, the government's going to say, nope, didn't happen. So let's go a little further. Buck Colbert Franklin, a Tulsa attorney and father of historian John Hope Franklin, also remembered turpentine balls falling from the sky. I could see planes circling in midair, Franklin wrote in a 10-page manuscript on a yellow legal pad that was discovered in 2015. They grew in number and hummed, darted and dipped low. I could hear something like hail falling upon the top of my office building. The sidewalks were literally covered with burning turpentine balls. I knew all too well where they came from, and I knew all too well why every burning building first caught from the top. Right? Why are all these buildings burning from the top down? According to the commission report, in the early 1950s, a middle-aged white man was overheard in a Tulsa barbershop bragging that he and a friend had flown an airplane over Greenwood during the massacre and dropped dynamite. Other accounts recall men with guns targeting fleeing residents from low-flying planes. A Mexican immigrant who lived at the edge of the Greenwood district later told family members she witnessed 2 black boys being followed down the street by a 2-seater plane. According to the commission report, the man in the rear seat was shooting at the boys. She then ran out, grabbed the boys, and took them into the house. To varying degrees, historians have accepted these accounts and tried to weigh the vast evidence against the plausibility of the bombings. There is enough evidence from African-American massacre survivors about seeing planes seemingly drop something from the planes and then hearing an explosion later on. But the historians are still trying to figure out what these turpentine balls are that are referenced. There's a gentleman named Ellsworth who is less convinced of reports of Molotov cocktails and turpentine balls. I believe without a doubt that Greenwood was bombed from the air, but more likely with sticks of dynamite. While it is certain that airplanes were used by the police force for recon and photographers, there probably was some whites who fired guns from planes and dropped bottles of gasoline or something of that sort, the report concluded. However, they were probably few in numbers. Again, it's just speculation. They don't know. Because from the sounds of it, from the eyewitness accounts, and from the destruction photos that you're going to look at, I mean, it's insanity. It looks like the destruction from the 1800s, guys. It looks like an atomic bomb was dropped. It looks like Dresden in World War II. It is just flattened. Nothing. Nothing left. As I said before, they destroyed everything they could. So we'll get into the destruction now. As Tulsa's black population was rounded up and taken to detention centers. Now, they had 3 detention centers. They had one at the convention hall, one at McNulty Park, and then one at the fairgrounds. While all these people were rounded up, looters and vandals descended on Greenwood District, setting fires, stealing, and destroying residents' possessions. Perfect time to destroy, loot, and pillage. Some of those involved were the very people who were supposed to bring order and chaos. Among them were the special deputies. Remember, we talked about them before, the 400 who got deputized that were appointed by Atkinson. And then we get into the Home Guard. What did they do? They singled out and terrorized those it deemed insufficiently supportive of the war effort. It also took action against those it considered immoral. Although officially disbanded in 1919, the members of the Home Guard apparently put on their own uniforms and waded into the fray on the morning of June 1st, 1921. So, much like any good spook, they came back. Most people, like myself, stayed in their homes expecting momentarily to be given protection by the home guards or state troops, E.A. Loop told Mary Jones Parish. Instead of protection by the home guards, they joined with the hoodlums in shooting at good citizens' homes. Colonel L.J.F. Rooney, the senior National Guard officer in Tulsa, complained, "There were many men in the Negro district wearing khaki clothes that looked like uniforms, who were not members of the National Guard." Tulsa police seem to have been involved in the mayhem. More than one witness identified officers, usually out of uniform, among the arsonists. V.B. Bostick, the black deputy sheriff, was rousted from his home by a white traffic officer named Pittman, who then joined in setting Bostick's home on fire. It said that a policeman turned him aside when Buck tried to save one of his buildings. It just makes no sense, guys. They're just out here acting like complete savages. And what was their response? "You ain't got no business building buildings for Negroes," he said. I mean, this is just ridiculous. After the homes vacated, one Greenwood resident said, a bunch of whites would come in and loot. Every woman with shopping bags would come in, open drawers, take every kind of finery from clothing to silverware to jewelry. Men were carrying out furniture, cursing as they do, saying, "These damn Negroes have got better things than lots of white people." There it is. That's why. Looting and pillaging because they wanted the material possessions that the others had. It says fire soon consumed Greenwood's main business district and more than 1,100 homes. Only a few houses, one or two churches on the perimeter of the community, and Booker T. Washington High School survived. Nothing, the Tulsa World reports the next day, that the mind is capable of conceiving permits the word of defense or excuse for the murderous vandalism inflicted on Greenwood. Now here's a disgusting account of what happened. The most prominent Tulsan killed in the riot was Dr. A.C. Jackson, a 40-year-old surgeon. According to Jackson's white neighbor, the former police commissioner and retired judge, John Oliphant, Jackson had raised his hands to surrender to a group of whites when two of them shot Jackson dead in what Oliphant called cold-blooded murder. Jackson lived on what was one of the most exclusive blocks in all of Greenwood. His neighbors included Booker T. Washington High School principal E.W. Woods, Tulsa Star publisher A.J. Smitherman, and physician R.T. Bridgewater. So he lived in the high end of town. Why Jackson, one of the gentlest of men, would have been singled out is not known. Perhaps he was mistaken for one of the more outspoken, Smitherman or Bridgewater. Perhaps he was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Or perhaps these scumbags were just looking to kill anything that moved, that was not the same color as them, which is probably the most likely scenario. The riot had all but died down off and said when Jackson came walking toward me with his hands in the air. "Here I am. I want to go with you," Jackson said. A body of about seven men, all armed, intercepted him, and two young fellows fired upon him. He fell to ground, and one of them fired again. Jackson's killers were never identified. I mean, it's just disgusting, guys. It's absolutely gross. By mid-morning on June 1st, the violence and destruction were beginning to subside. The Tulsa National Guardsmen soon reinforced by units from Oklahoma City and other communities. They began to secure Greenwood. So at like 11:15 in the morning, the governor declared martial law and put the adjutant general in charge, Charles Barrett. Some looting continued through the afternoon until evening. Until by evening, about 30 whites had been arrested for pillaging. According to some accounts, the Oklahoma City units, which included a machine gun company, were involved in the final attack on Mount Zion Baptist Church. This is not mentioned in any of the officers' action reports and seems unlikely since those troops did not arrive until 9:30 a.m., by which time the church was already on fire. Yeah, it's interesting because I've seen, and you'll see pictures of this machine gun truck. Right, they had a machine gun truck with a machine gun mounted turret on the back and just driving around the city. I mean, that's never good. Never good. By midday on June 1st, Greenwood had been emptied but all of a handful of inhabitants. A few found refuge in downtown churches or the homes of white employers, acquaintances, or even strangers, right? They're hiding. Fewer still somehow rode out the riot in their own homes. The majority by far had either fled the city or been taken into what was described as protective custody, or an internment camp. Forced to march for blocks through white neighborhoods with their hands in the air, while their homes and possessions burned behind them, the detainees were subject to harassment and humiliation. Some were robbed of whatever valuables they had managed to stuff in their pockets. I mean, this is just the lowest of the low. It's so degrading and so disgusting that not only are these innocent people being removed from their homes while their homes are being looted and burned, while they're walking to these internment camps, they're being robbed of what little possessions they were able to throw in their pockets. I mean, it's just, I don't know how, these people aren't human. It's that's not human behavior. It's disgusting. They were taken to the convention hall, and it proved inadequate. So then they had McNulty Park, which is a minor league baseball stadium, and then they finally moved them to the fairgrounds because they just didn't have enough room. Through the afternoon into the next day, the National Guard patrols went into the countryside to pick up Greenwood residents. Detainees were given food, water, and medical attention that first day. The Black Hospital had been burned, so a makeshift clinic for injured blacks was set up by the National Guard. Many detainees were released within a few hours, while others remained at the fairground camps for weeks. Generally, detainees were held, listen to this, until a white person vouched for them, at which point they were given a card to wear on their clothes. Where have we heard that before? Oh, it's just a star. Come on, guys. Come on. Those without cards were subject to arrest. Right? And that's where we're going. Right? How many companies made people that got a certain medical procedure wear a certain color armband to designate what status they were? Guys, this is disgusting stuff. I mean, man, and this is what's coming. If you let it keep going, we're going right back to this. This is what humans are capable of. Those with nowhere else to go were allowed to stay at the fairground camp, regardless of whether or not they had been released. At its height, the camp housed about 5,000. However, those who remained were required to pay for their meals, either out of their pockets or working various tasks, including cleaning up debris from Greenwood. So they had to go clean up their burnt homes, their burnt businesses. They had to go clean up the devastation so they could eat, so they could pay off their debt to the people that just burned all their stuff down. That's how kind these people are. They gave them a job, right? And it says here, yeah, for this they were paid standard laborers' wages. It was by no means an easy existence, but some whites soon complained that blacks were being spoiled at the fairgrounds and by attention given to them by the Red Cross and other charitable organizations. Although the destruction of Greenwood was generally condemned by the black and white Tulsans alike, overall blame was quickly assigned to the blacks who had gone to the courthouse to protect Dick Rowland. Of course. Yeah, we're just trying to protect this guy who has been threatened to be lynched, and we're going to blame them. That makes sense. Makes perfect sense. So now, what's the net of this? Okay, property damage in Greenwood was put at $1.5 to $2 million at the time, when a good house could be built for less than $1,000. According to the Red Cross, 1,256 homes were burned and another 215 looted but not destroyed. So you have 1,500 homes, approximately, that were either burned and or looted. The true death toll will probably never be known. 37 death certificates were issued for riot-related fatalities, but most experts believe the total was higher, perhaps much higher. Hundreds and perhaps thousands were injured. Of the 37 death certificates, 25 were black males, 12 for white males. 9 black victims, burned beyond recognition, were not identified. The number of dead and injured has been the subject of controversy from the very start. Early on, Tulsa World reported 100 dead, then scaled it down to 30. Some saying bodies had been counted twice, and others thought dead were only injured. There was indeed much confusion. Some people reported dead weren't. Some reported slightly injured were, in fact, dead. A few of the dead were either misidentified or had been living under assumed names. According to the Red Cross, many people, especially whites, were reluctant to seek medical attention for even major injuries. On June 3, 1921, just 2 days after the riot, the Tulsa World reported that 13 black victims of the riot were buried in Oaklawn Cemetery in separate graves and in plain caskets, a description that suggests a suspicion of something otherwise even then. In 1999 and 2000, a commission authorized by the Oklahoma legislature and the Oklahoma Geological Survey probed for mass burial sites in several locations in Tulsa, including New Block Park, Oaklawn Cemetery, and the former Booker T. Washington Cemetery. Their search was unsuccessful. Now, some of the other things you'll hear, though, is that some of these bodies were thrown in rivers. Some of these were buried in mass graves that were not found. So the death toll number, it will never truly be known, but it's way too high. Regardless, I don't care if it's even the 37 death certificates. We know it's more than that, but 37 is way too much for something that should never have escalated. It didn't even happen. Nothing happened. A guy tripped. A girl screamed. And now we have a full-on race riot destroying a town. A grand jury convened the second week of June said the armed blacks at the courthouse were the direct cause of the riot, but said indirect causes were more to blame. Among the indirect causes cited were the agitation for social equality and lax law enforcement. 88 indictments were issued, mostly for black men, but few seem to have been served. A few people arrested during and after the riot were convicted of or pleaded guilty to minor crimes such as possession of stolen property. Immediately after the riot, a group of white businessmen proposed moving the black neighborhood further northeast and converting Greenwood area to a warehouse district. Oh, how nice of you. The effort ultimately failed when the business group could not raise the necessary capital. In September, Tulsa's three district judges ruled the city had illegally extended its fire code in an attempt to thwart blacks from rebuilding. Their decision effectively ended the real estate group's scheme. Finally, that's one of the few times the court system came through. The group's efforts, though, helped feed suspicions of conspiracy or cover-up. Some have suggested the entire incident, including the encounter between Dick Rowland and Sarah Page, had been staged to provide an excuse to lay waste to Greenwood. They point to the actions or inaction of authorities during the buildup to the riot and failure to protect Greenwood property on the morning of June 1st. This sounds exactly like January 6th, right? January 6th could have been prevented if law enforcement did their job, if the Capitol Police did their job, if they did not open up the gates and let people in, if they did not guide people through the Capitol. There were also claims that blacks who went to the courthouse wanted a fight. According to later testimony and notes found in the papers of the governor, hotel owner John Stratford had exhorted the men at the Tulsa Star office with the promise to send and get the Muskegee crowd, that is, reinforcements from the nearby city of Muskegee. The African Blood Brotherhood, an arm of the Communist Party based in New York, claimed to have had a chapter in Tulsa organizing armed resistance of racial oppression. So now we have African communists. How convenient. Wow. I mean, these stories, guys, you gotta laugh sometimes, right? It's the same stories written over and over again. We're in the same thing. Think about the summer of 2020, where police and everybody just let rioters go loose, right? They didn't even try to stop them. But yet peaceful protesters would face law enforcement and arrests, beatings. It's comical. But they always hide. They always gaslight you. to make it seem like it's the victim's fault. Stratford and Smitherman were arrested after the riot, posted bail, and left Oklahoma forever. Stratford settled in Chicago, where his family became prominent. Smitherman opened a newspaper in Buffalo. Now, what I find interesting about this is, where did these guys go? One went to Chicago, home of a World Fair in 1893. One went to Buffalo, home of a World Fair in 1901. There's something about these cities, guys. There's something to this. And I'm going to connect it eventually. But on the other side, look what happens to these prominent guys. Stratford, luckily, was able to rebuild. Smitherman was able to kind of get his life back in Buffalo. But why did they have to go there? These guys were Oklahoma legends. In July, a jury found Police Chief John Gustafson guilty of dereliction of duty and removed from office. Now get this, he resumed his career as a private investigator. So we're not going to take away his badge. No. It's okay. In September, a large Ku Klux Klan rally was held at Convention Hall. It was the Klan's first public appearance in Tulsa, although many people believed it had a hand in the riot. The original Klan, organized during Reconstruction, had been broken up in the 1870s, but a new organization was formed in Atlanta in 1915. The Klan promoted a broader agenda than its predecessor, based not only on racism and white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, or WASP, but vigilante enforcement of its own moral code. And this is why you started seeing all these lynchings, right? This is a very Nazi-esque mentality. In April 1922, more than 1,700 Klan members marched through downtown Tulsa while an airplane carrying electrically lighted cross flew overhead. In that spring's election, Klan candidates swept every office and did the same when county elections came around in the fall. In August of 1923, Governor J.C. Walton declared martial law in Tulsa County because of Klan activity. Most insurance claims stemming from the riot were denied because policies typically excluded such damage. And this is another scam, guys. Insurance. It's a big, giant fraud. When you need it, it ends up costing you more. Scores of lawsuits were filed as a result. One by white property owner William Redfern alleged the riot had in fact been a police action. Redfern produced a number of witnesses who said police actively participated in the destruction of Greenwood. Redfern's suit was dismissed, as were all others. Few property owners were ever reimbursed for their losses. Okay, so you buy insurance, but it's not covered for that. They get you that all the time, right? With water damage. It depends which way the water came in and all that stuff. Oh, it's such a scam. It's all bullshit. So, these families that lost everything had to live in tents and makeshift shacks in their old neighborhood for much of the next year. But eventually the neighborhood did rebuild, reaching its peak during World War II. It didn't come near to where it used to be, but at least it was able to rebuild. Now think about how degrading that is. To be in a tent or a makeshift shack on your property that these white scumbags just burnt down. The police burnt down. It's just insanity. Before the Tulsa race riot of 1921. Oh, this is interesting. Okay. Now, some of you guys are familiar with this. This may be before some of your time. The main road that went through Black Wall Street was Greenwood Avenue, okay, which intersected by Archer and Pine Streets. There was an R&B band known as the Gap Band. They came up with their name from the first letters of each of those roads, Greenwood, Archer, and Pine Street Band, the Gap Band. The nucleus of the group consisted of brothers Ronnie, Robert, and Charlie Wilson, who were born and raised in Tulsa, Oklahoma. One of the Gap Band's most successful songs performed by the group was, guess, You Dropped the Bomb on Me, written by Lonnie Simmons, Rudy Taylor, and Charlie Wilson. What are the chances? Now, most people will say nah, this, you know, it was written about a girl that broke up with a guy. All right. I think it may be a little bit deeper than that. You dropped the bomb on me, baby. Good song. The old Tulsa County Courthouse, where Dick Rowland was held and the shooting began, was, as most buildings are, demolished in 1960 to make way for a 32-story bank building. The police station, the Hotel Tulsa, and McGee's and Barden Sporting Goods stores are long gone. The armory where the National Guard faced down angry whites has for decades been a Veterans of Foreign Wars hall. Mount Zion Baptist Church rebuilt, thankfully, slowly and painfully, though, over a period of many years. A freeway runs where the fairgrounds and Dr. A.C. Jackson's house once stood and cuts old Greenwood into two. Formerly bustling business district was reduced to a single block. Okay, remember what we said when this started? It was 35 blocks. Now, in, what is this, 97, 98, it's down to one block. It just sucks. It's American history, right? The American dream. In 1997, Oklahoma legislator authorized a special commission to investigate the Tulsa riot. The commission's report, issued in 2001, recommended reparations for living black survivors of the riot. However, the recommendation was never acted upon. In 2003, a federal lawsuit was filed against the state of Oklahoma, the city of Tulsa, and the Tulsa PD on behalf of about 200 survivors and descendants of black living in Greenwood at the time of the riot. In 2004, the courts, you guessed it, dismissed the suit, ruling the statute of limitations had run out. Then in 2007, the Tulsa County District Attorney formally dismissed the original indictment against alleged riot participants. Why? Why would you do this? For many Tulsans, the riot remains a sensitive and controversial issue. For some, it is merely something that happened long ago with little relevance today. For others, however, it remains a symbol of oppression and prejudice that speaks to modern race relations. The opening of John Hope Franklin Reconciliation Park, adjoining 1OK Field, that's the city's minor league baseball stadium, which they still have. It's hoping to bring new life to Greenwood. All right. It's also, you know, hoping to bring some attention to the history as well. At the 2008 dedication of the park named in his honor, John Hope Franklin, in one of the last public appearances before his death, he said, "Someday we'll have the joy and pleasure of complete reconciliation. We're moving in that direction. I hope we get there very soon." And I agree with Mr. Franklin. I hope we get there very soon. Now, are race relations today nearly as bad as they used to be? Nope. But if you listen to the media, they're doing the same thing that newspaper did back in 1921. They are pouring gasoline on the fire and selectively picking stories to further their agendas. Okay, and we have to understand this. It's funny because it always benefits one side, right? It always benefits the government. Never does it benefit the people. It always is more power, more laws, more fees, taxes, fines, permits. And that's what we have to start realizing. These governments that are supposed to be for the people, of the people, by the people, right? They are of the corporation, for the corporation, and now bought by the corporation. So we have to understand this. And what does that mean? That they want to have haves and have-nots. The middle class will be gone. There will be the rich, and there will be the rest. And most of us will be in the rest category. And that's what we saw here in Tulsa. We saw a black community build from scratch into the wealthiest black community in America that was self-reliant, built from within, and destroyed by ignorance. And that's all it is, guys. It's just ignorance and greed, jealousy. But they were jealous of what these people had that they could never attain. So what were they going to do? We'll just take it from them. We'll just burn it down. That, guys, in a nutshell, is the American way. At least from the government standpoint. We're going to take whatever we want. We're going to burn it down. And then you can have whatever is left over. That's your government. And you people think they care about you. They give a shit about your health, yet they feed you poison. They give a shit about your health, but they will give you pharmaceuticals that have long-lasting effects. They'll give this all to you, but there's a price to pay. And eventually, you're going to have to pay it. Eventually, they come for you. And it's the way it is. So be careful, because what do we have now? We have the Ministry of Truth, right? I forgot what the actual Department of Disinformation or something like that. But guys, all that's going to be is whatever party's in charge, you can't speak against them. And whatever policies they're going to enact for that time frame is, oh, you can't say these words, right? And that's what we're going to get into. We're going to get eventually dumbed down to a point where we're only allowed to use a certain amount of words. Because much like these people in Tulsa, when you are independent, you are powerful. You don't need government. You don't need anything else when you can support yourself. And that's the thing that government fears the most. Other than us coming to their house with pitchforks and torches and carrying them out, the one thing that they fear is us not needing them. And that's why we got to start thinking, especially now, about how can I lessen my dependence on the government? Because most of us, the majority of us, are not going to be able to break free completely. But we can separate small victories, growing some of your own food, raising some of your own animals, getting involved in your local communities. These are all things, guys, that can help strengthen the bond and help prevent things like what happened in Tulsa from ever taking place again. And it shouldn't. Should never. But unfortunately, we're going to see something like this again. You know, it's history repeats itself. It's just a wave that we keep riding. And you go down and you go up and you go down and you go up. And you see it here. In the 1920s, they were pushing the communist scare. Then it kind of fell by the wayside. Then it came back hard after World War II. Then it kind of fell by the wayside. Now it came back hard in 2020. And now, oh, those evil Russians, right? They're not even communist anymore, but they're worse than they've ever been. Because they're fighting the pure and heavenly body of Vladimir Zelensky, puppet du jour. All right, guys, that's enough of a rant for tonight. But I want to say, go check out, look into this. I mean, go see some of the pictures. The devastation is, it's disgusting. To see what they built, it was beautiful. To see the people, the luxury, you know, the lifestyle that these people had made for themselves. I mean, it was a beautiful thing that over potentially a false flag, something that was intentionally set up, destroyed it all in one day. And that's what we have to understand here, guys. Everything can change in one day. So enjoy it. Enjoy it. Do me a favor. If you like the show, leave a rating, leave a review, share it with your friends. Go support my YouTube channel. Subscribe. Click the little bell if you can so you get notifications. I'm going to start putting some stuff up there. Like I said, right now it's tough with baseball season. But once baseball season's over, I got a bunch of videos I want to crank out and some other stuff. So go support that. You can go check out the Patreon. You can go check out make contributions through Venmo. Go check out the store. The Great Deception podcast gear. Get your gear today. And I will stand by, the t-shirts are comfortable. Great lightweight t-shirts, they fit well. Sweatshirt's nice and light, it's not too heavy. Not one of those big bulky sweatshirts, it's a good, nice, comfortable hoodie. So get your GDP gear. And with that said, I'm going to leave you for tonight. So as always, stay strong and question everything.
Why do you think that is? I mean, why is that? I mean, is it just because people are lazy today or they're bored? I mean, are we just like bored, spoiled children who've just been lying in the bathtub all day, just playing with their plastic duck, and now they're just thinking, well, what can I do? Okay, yes, we are bored. We're all bored now. But has it ever occurred to you, Wally, that the process that creates this boredom that we see in the world now may very well be a self-perpetuating, unconscious form of brainwashing created by a world totalitarian government based on money? And that all of this is much more dangerous than one thinks? And it's not just a question of individual survival, Wally, but that somebody who's bored is asleep, and somebody who's asleep will not say no? See, I keep meeting these people. I mean, just a few days ago, I met this man whom I greatly admire. He's a Swedish physicist, Gustav Bjornstrand, and he told me that he no longer watches television, he doesn't read newspapers, and he doesn't read magazines. He's completely cut them out of his life because he really does feel that we're living in some kind of Orwellian nightmare now, and that everything that you hear now contributes to turning you into a robot. When I met him at Findhorn, he said to me, "Where are you from?" And I said, "New York." He said, "Ah, New York, yes, that's a very interesting place. Do you know a lot of New Yorkers who keep talking about the fact that they want to leave but never do?" And I said, "Oh, yes." And he said, "Why do you think they don't leave?" I gave him different banal theories. He said, "Oh, I don't think it's that way at all." He said, "I think that New York is the new model for the new concentration camp, where the camp has been built by the inmates themselves, and the inmates are the guards, and they have this pride in this thing they've built. They've built their own prison, and so they exist in a state of schizophrenia, where they are both guards and prisoners, and as a result, they no longer have, having been lobotomized, the capacity to leave the prison they've made or to even see it as a prison." And then he went into his pocket and he took out a seed for a tree and he said, "This is a pine tree." He put it in my hand and he said, "Escape before it's too late." Of course, the problem is where to go, because it seems quite obvious that the whole world is going in the same direction. This is the beginning of the rest of the future now, that from now on there'll simply be all these robots walking around, feeling nothing, thinking nothing. And there'll be nobody left almost to remind them that there once was a species called a human being with feelings and thoughts, and that history and memory are right now being erased, and soon nobody will really remember that life existed on the planet.